Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LXIII, Women Poets. All our talk of Roman writing has focused on men, for the simple reason that, for the most part, that is all we have. This makes the fragments of work we have by Roman women an important aspect of life and culture in ancient Rome. Unfortunately, we have so little of it that can be covered in a single episode. Here's Rhiannon Evans. What can we say about women writers in Rome? Was it something that only the higher classes did? Was it an acceptable pastime? Was it widespread?
Well, most of the evidence we have for women writers is, I guess you could say, images of women actually doing writing, because we don't have very much extant writing. So there are famous little small portraits of women with a book, or there are sometimes relief sculptures of women working with books, maybe doing accounts. There's a really famous one of a woman with a big book in a butcher's shop. There's a man chopping up meat, and the woman's just sitting on this sort of throne looking at probably the accounts. So that doesn't really count as a writer. But what it does tell us is that at least some women were literate, and they're not necessarily from the very elite. But in terms of writing poetry, it's pretty much the case that with men as well, you tend to be from the elite to have the time to produce poetry.
And the knowledge of how it works and even how to write?
Well, I guess the education, yes. Now, some people would actually contradict this, and it is very, very difficult to say given the small amount of evidence we have. But there are things like graffiti in Pompeii that show us that people were familiar, presumably ordinary people if they're scrawling things on walls, are familiar with what we would think of as the great poetic works. So there's loads of graffiti in Pompeii that either copies or sometimes makes fun of the Aeneid. So that shows a knowledge of that poetry. So that certainly seeped down. And I guess that what we're often reminded by scholars is that knowledge of this poetry doesn't just come from being able to read the text. So even if literacy was relatively low, people would have heard them.
Yeah, sure.
So it's a very much an oral culture. So bearing all of that in mind, that's a very roundabout way of saying we really don't know what percentage of people were literate in the Roman world. And for women, we kind of have even less knowledge, if it's possible to have less. But we know that some of them were, because some of them wrote. And our most famous case from the Roman world writing in Latin is Sulpicia. But we know there were other women writing and in some cases speaking aloud, because a writer called Valerius Maximus, who's writing in the time of Tiberius, he talks about women who are orators. They must have been able to read and write and then actually read out their speeches.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
They're just names to us. We don't have anything by them, which is really unfortunate. But they did exist. And we do have some instances of people signing off on their poetry, which we would call graffiti, but it's a little bit more than just writing, you know, I was here.
Yes.
Kind of graffiti.
So let's talk about the writers that we do have. We'll start with the most extensive work that we do have by a female poet from ancient Rome, which is Sulpicia.
There were two women called Sulpicia that we know about. They were both poets from ancient Rome, from the late 1st century BCE and the late 1st century CE. They're the two main female poets we know about, and they're both called Sulpicia, which is a bit unfortunate in terms of distinguishing people.
Do you think that's their actual names?
That's a good question, because certainly pseudonyms were used, and they were used particularly within love poems, and the first Sulpicia in particular wrote love poems. So possibly it's a pseudonym. It's a very suitable name for an elite Roman woman, which Sulpicia was. So as far as I know, nobody has ever questioned whether that's really her name. I guess the second one could have been playing on it, but we know her mostly through people writing about her, so unlikely. The first Sulpicia, who's an Augustan poet writing in the age of Augustus, so late 1st century BCE, is the only female poet we have from ancient Rome writing in Latin still remaining to us, which is really sad because we know there were other female poets. We have names. But in terms of published poetry, what we would call a corpus of poetry, Sulpicia is it.
Yeah.
And we only have 6 poems by her.
So there would have been a lot more at some stage.
Probably. We don't know.
Okay.
Now, I know you're sick of me saying this, but we don't know much about Saltpicia.
I was about to ask, what do we know about her? We know nothing other than...
No, we do know a little bit more. Now, the whole process is complicated because Saltpicia's poetry was often published as part of the poetry of another Augustan poet, a male poet called Tibullus. So it's still often part of the Tibullan corpus. And in fact, when I was an undergrad, we didn't really learn about Saltpicia. And it was just this sort of appendix in Tibullus. It's almost like her work has been taken over by Tibullus.
Mm.
Now, there is sort of a reason for this. And this is that Saltpicia was the niece of a man called Messala. And Messala was the patron of Tibullus. So there was a connection between them. They would have known each other. She writes the same kind of poetry as Tibullus,
yeah,
which is called elegiac poetry, which is usually love poetry written in groups of elegiac couplets, long line, short line.
And there just being 5 poems that we've got of her,
6
poems, is not sufficient enough for its own lerb.
No, she gets published along with Tibullus in the lerb, but then Tibullus gets published along with Propertius anyway. So elegiac poetry, each author, you know, we have a small amount of each of them and they all get shoved together.
Yeah.
Except Ovid, who's got a lot more poetry, as we know. Anyway, she is distinguished enough to be published along with Tibullus, but there's this complicated kind of history of her being hidden in the Tibullan corpus. And more recently, scholars have sort of rediscovered Saltpicia and started to publish about her because elegiac poetry, you know, it's love poetry from the point of view of a man, often depicts the man as being subservient to the woman. But Saltpicia is a kind of interesting overturning of that dynamic because it's a woman writing about her love, which kind of traps her, which is the sort of dynamic that elegy sets up.
Yeah.
So, you know, love is a trap. You get enslaved, which no Roman man should be in that position. At the same time that they talk about being enslaved, that male voice is actually the one in control.
Mm.
It's the thing that creates the female lover. So Saltpicia, she creates for us the male lover. She has a heterosexual relationship with a man that she calls Corinthus. And she talks about that, and at some point he betrays her. It's just 6 poems, but we kind of get a whole narrative. And she talks about how she's desolate and she feels humiliated by this. So we do get the story of a relationship through these 6 short poems. And when I say short poems, I'm talking about each one being around, well, between 4 and maybe 16 lines long.
Yeah. So without trying to put it down or anything, is it chick lit? was that the kind of intended point of it?
No, I wouldn't call it chick lit, although I can see why that kind of novel is written from the point of view of a woman and it's about her love affairs.
Yeah.
But I guess that term tends to invoke sort of easily read stuff you'd read on a plane sort of literature. Doesn't it? Maybe I'm wrong.
I wouldn't know.
It doesn't have a high literary quality, most of it anyway. Mm. Whereas there's no indication that Saltpicia was regarded as anything trashy. Her poetry's of fairly high quality. So she's up there with Tibullus and the other elegists.
Sure. Okay.
It's just that there's so very little of it.
Yes. All right. So did you want to take me through some of it?
Yes. I can briefly describe each of the poems and I'll read out some of them.
Okay.
They are numbered 1 to 6. And number 1 clearly is meant to be the beginning of the love affair where she falls in love. And she says, "At last, it's come, love. That kind that veiling will give me reputation more than showing my soul naked to someone." So in other words, she's talking about, I need to broadcast my love. You know, Roman women are meant to be modest and chaste, but she's overturning that stereotype and saying it would be bad for my reputation if I covered this up because it's so important, this overwhelming love. So she's already dealing with the stereotype of Roman women there. She interestingly says that she prayed to Aphrodite in Latin. And that's what it actually says in the Latin.
Mm.
So in other words, she's praying to Venus, but she refers to her as Aphrodite and then follows it up by in Latin. I'm going along in the Greek tradition, but I'm writing in Latin. So she's kind of culturally aware there and making us aware of it. And it worked. She says, I prayed to Aphrodite in Latin in poems, and she brought him, snuggled him into my bosom. Venus has kept her promises. It's quite cute, I think, the beginning of the first poem.
Yeah.
And she continues to talk about reputation throughout this poem. At the same time as she says, it would be bad for my reputation to keep it covered up, it's clearly on her mind in the persona of this poem. And it ends with the lines, may I be said to be a worthy lover for a worthy love. So there's this idea that they're equally matched and that this is something that's dignified.
Yeah. So how long was that poem?
That poem is 10 lines long.
10 lines long?
Just 10 lines.
Yeah.
The second one is about her birthday, and she talks about how she's not enjoying it because Corinthus is not going to be there.
No.
It's the first time she names him.
But you're assuming that it's the same guy that she was writing about from the first
one. There
seems
to be that implication, okay. But it's true that you shouldn't necessarily do that with love poetry, assume that it's always the same. But her corpus being so short, it looks like it's the same love affair being portrayed throughout. And she actually mentions her uncle Messala there, the guy who was the patron of the other poet, Tibullus. Now, Uncle Messala, do take a rest. You've always looked after me too well. There are times, you know, when travel's a bad idea. So you're taking me away to the country, away from Corinthus. It's supposed to be a birthday treat, but I don't want to go. I've been kidnapped. It's not letting me be my own mistress. So there's this idea she wants to take charge of her life. But being a woman in Roman society, even a high-born woman, you know, she's always kind of under somebody else's control. So that's quite interesting that she's actually dealing with those ideas. By poem four, though, it's all going terribly wrong. And this is the poem where she really almost gets as angry as we've seen in poems like Martial's. She doesn't quite use the obscenity that Martial does. But she manages to convey the idea that she's really angry. And she's also looking down from her elite standpoint because Corinthus has apparently betrayed her with a woman way below her in status.
So she
can have some snide little remarks about this.
Yes.
And she does. And she's also deeply sarcastic at the beginning. So I'll try to convey that in the way I read it. Thank you for taking such pains over me, for keeping me from making a fool of myself. I do hope you enjoy the bimbo. Her flashy clothes do cast a subtly shabby light on Sulpicia Servi Filia. That means Sulpicia, the daughter of Servius. I am the daughter of a Roman citizen. Clearly this other bimbo, as she calls her, is not.
This is Chiclet.
And she ends, however, it's quite sad at the end of this poem. It's very, very short, so just a couple more lines. They're a little worried about me, afraid I might trip up and marry a nobody.
Oh.
So her family's worried about her state of mind. Then she gets a little sadder. It is a real narrative runs through these poems. Poem five starts, do you think kindly of your girl, Corinthus, now that a fever attacks my limbs? So she's unwell and she's wondering whether Corinthus is still thinking about her. And she ends by talking about regretting things in her life. It's very short, the last poem. Five and six are both 6 lines long. May I never be, O dawn of my life, as warm a care to you as I seem to have been a few days ago. If, fool that I am, I've done anything in all my short life that I might admit to regretting more than leaving you alone last night, passionate only to hide my passion. So there's a kind of a last sad poem which talks about regrets and actually not indulging herself in this love affair, which, of course, as a respectable Roman woman, she has to do. So she's sort of on that threshold of talking about love, which as a Roman woman is something that's presumably quite taboo, certainly physical love, but regretting not being part of that milieu. And she has to be on this pedestal of elite Roman woman, as we saw in the fourth poem, where she names herself daughter of an elite Roman man. So it's an interesting point of view that we get. Well, Sulpicia. I mean, we have to say that this is a poetic persona that she's creating, but it certainly reflects things about an elite Roman woman's position in society and quite how far she can go.
This would have been published as a collection, so I wouldn't have liked to have been Corinthus. I suppose it's a bit of an ultimate revenge to publish a scathing work.
Well, there is a tradition in elegy, at least according to a later writer called Apuleius, and in other types of poetry too, but particularly in elegy, of using a pseudonym for the name of the lover.
Oh, why would you?
Usually the pseudonym is the same number of syllables as the real name, so that those who know can just slot that person's name in there. It's got the same metrical rhythm.
Yeah.
And those who don't will never know. And so his name might not have been Corinthus, or he might not have existed, because unlike the male poets in this account of using pseudonyms, Apuleius doesn't list Sulpicia and tell us what the real name of the lover was. Now, he might not have known about her. He might have thought that Tibullus did write these poems and pretending to be a woman. Or maybe he just decided it wasn't important enough to list, or he didn't know the real name. But it might not have been Corinthus. Corinthus certainly sounds like it's a Greek name, and it might be a pseudonym to cover over an elite Roman man's name.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so the second Sulpicia that we've got, I take it she's much later.
She is. She is known to us largely because she's mentioned by Martial. Martial's very complimentary about her and says that she's a very upstanding, correct Roman woman who loved her husband as a Roman woman should, and a great poet too. It's actually Martial Book 10, Poem 38. It seems to have been written on her death, so bemoaning the fact that she has died after a long, happy marriage. She wrote love poems too. They're addressed to her husband, Calenus, and according to Martial, they convey her total fidelity, but also a bold sensuality.
Mm.
We only have one fragment remaining. It's quite sensual stuff. It's very partial, so there's bits of the lines missing. But it seems to say, me, the linen, the slinging restored, and then the interesting line, naked, making love with Calenus, exposed.
All right.
So clearly, she was not writing that modest, chaste stuff that you might associate with Roman women. And Martial's quite right that she did write a very openly erotic verse.
Well, this is what remains of women authors back from Roman period. Were there a lot of others?
We do have names of others mentioned, of both authors and female orators as well, surprisingly.
Yeah.
But they are just names to us, and they kind of come in lists from people like Quintilian, who wrote about Roman oratory, Roman rhetoric, and Valerius Maximus, who kind of writes about Roman phenomena, Roman memorabilia, as they're called. Mm. So they don't even give us fragments. Usually. So we have very, very little. We actually have far more Greek verse, ancient Greek verse written by women preserved, which seems to be a quirk of preservation and an unfortunate one for those of us studying Roman poetry. I guess we should just regard ourselves as lucky to have what we do have. And what we do have is at least six complete poems that are of high quality, interesting in that we can compare them with verse that's very similar, written by men around the same time, and we can to a certain extent contextualize Sulpicia. We know a little bit about her family, which is more than we know about some male poets.
Mm.
If you want to read all of Sulpicia's poems, which won't take you very long, there's a great translation on a website called Diotima, which is D-I-O-T-I-M-A, by Lee Piercy. And they're all listed there, so you can look at them there. If you want the Latin, it's available on a site called the Latin Library. That's true of most Latin.
So Sulpicia is as far as female Roman poets go, quite well known, but there are certain fragments that we've got of other poets, isn't there?
There's some poetry that we know of because it's been scrawled onto to a monument, and it might have been signed by a woman's name.
So this isn't published works then?
Absolutely not. Yeah. No, not in the way we would regard poetry as published, I suppose. That's actually another big question, what published means in the ancient world, because they didn't have publishing houses as such. But they're not being copied out in manuscript form and handed around. They might only exist in this one place on this block of stone. Perhaps the best known and the most easily accessible examples are on the statue of Memnon in Egypt. Now, this statue is covered in graffiti, and it includes the work of a female poet called Julia Balbilla, who we covered when we looked at the statue of Memnon. She was part of the court, the entourage of the Emperor Hadrian. And we looked at Hadrian's visit to Memnon and some of the graffiti that's written on there. But as well as Julia, we've got some work by Caecilia Trebulla, who, you know, clearly knows the rules of poetry. She's writing in what we call iambic poetry, which is the de-dum, de-dum, de-dum kind of meter, the same kind of meter that Shakespeare uses. And she writes in a way that shows she's aware of Greek culture. Even though she's very much part of the Roman world, because her name, Caecilia Trebulla, fixes her as having a Roman name, she's writing in Greek. Now, that's not that unusual, because educated Romans all knew Greek and would often work in it. So another great example we've got is Marcus Aurelius writing his philosophy in Greek. It's not that unusual. He's a Roman emperor. And Caecilia Trebulla, she knows about Greek philosophy. She knows about Greek poetry. She basically knows Greek literature well. And she's writing her poems on this statue, you know, with reference to the statue, with her hearing, as they thought, the statue sing, because it emitted this loud noise. So here's a nice, short, simple one, and it is actually signed, as it were, by Trebulla. And she says, "When I heard the holy voice of Memnon, I longed for you, mother, and I prayed for you too to hear it." Quite sort of nice and simple, and also kind of conveys emotion, because some people would just write on the statue, "I heard Memnon."
And right. A lot of people did.
Yeah. That was the simple way of, and I mean, that's the more kind of "I was here" kind of graffiti. Whereas this is poetry. It's written in meter. It's talking about a connection with a family member. It actually reminds me in some ways of a tradition going back to the poet Sappho, another Greek female poet from the 6th century BCE. And I think that she might be recalling Sappho here, because Sappho often talks about her relationships with family members, with her daughter being very strong, and her affection and emotion. So she may be actually playing into a tradition of Greek female poets and seeing herself in that tradition. So this is kind of intriguing that we've got this poetry here that may not have been well known outside. It may have been, it's just that we don't know about it, but it may only have been known through being put onto this statue. And that is what's preserved it for us.
And this statue has two female Roman writers doing poetry, which, you know, we don't have a lot of to start with, and there's two of them writing in the same location.
Yeah, well, it's said that there's 6% of all the content of female written poetry on this statue from the ancient world. Now, most of it's Greek, right? If any of it were written in Latin, it would be a much higher percentage, because we have hardly any Latin poetry. We have a lot more Greek poetry written by women.
So 7 poems is 6%.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
It's really quite sad. And one of the reasons for that is that we don't even have all of Sappho. We have a lot of fragments of Sappho, and she's the best known ancient poet. We've probably lost a lot. I don't think it's too controversial these days to say, because of prejudice, that women writers just weren't copied out as much as male writers. So that's very unfortunate. And possibly there were fewer of them in the first place. They had fewer opportunities to express themselves in this way. So it's really amazing that we have this collection left, this very, very small collection. And it gives us some insight into the fact that there were female poets operating, really thinking about the mechanics of poetry and spelling it out, as it were, in the early 2nd century.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in iTunes. Consider leaving us a review there, because it makes us feel appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we ask you for some questions, and we'll give you some answers. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.